It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, House Republicans passed President Trump's signature spending plan. That bill included substantial cuts to Medicaid funding. Analysts estimate that the changes will affect thousands of Wisconsinites enrolled in programs like Badger Care Plus, in part because of new eligibility requirements for some recipients.
The funding cuts and new requirements around Medicaid could also create new challenges for rural hospitals that are already under financial stress.
Donna Friedsam is a distinguished researcher emerita and former health policy programs director at UW-Madison. Donna, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good to be with you.
Before we get to the new legislation, can you remind us what Medicaid funds in Wisconsin? It shows up under a number of different labels and names.
Medicaid includes what people frequently refer to as Badger Care or Badger Care Plus in Wisconsin, and sometimes Forward Health. People may have a card in their wallets labeled as Forward Health, and it funds 20% of Wisconsin residents overall, one in five. About 40% of all births in Wisconsin, 40% of children are covered by Medicaid, and 60% of people in nursing homes and long-term care are elderly and disabled people.
When you see the final version of this bill now passed by Congress, what caught your eye? What are some of the most important changes to Medicaid that we're seeing?
Well, there's a number of changes in this bill, and one of the things I want to make sure to emphasize while I'm with you is that the bill makes changes to Medicaid and also has effects to the Affordable Care Act, which goes hand in hand with Medicaid, which will have significant effects to coverage in Wisconsin overall. And so in Medicaid, what we've been hearing about a lot is the work requirements, and what it's going to require is that what are called able-bodied adults ages 19 to 64 who do not have children under age 14 will need to demonstrate and document that they are working or otherwise training or attending school for at least 80 hours monthly. And that does not mean that these people are not already doing so, but that there will be new documentation and reporting requirements for these people. It also includes new requirements for enrolling in and renewing coverage twice a year. So every 6 months, everybody who is in Medicaid will need to demonstrate their eligibility for the program in order to continue to be in the program. And then there are new co-payments associated with the program participation for people who are visiting providers. And then various things that don't directly affect the consumer, but will affect the financing of the program related to how providers are how money gets transferred to providers and how the program pulls down money from the federal government, which are referred to as provider taxes.
Let's look at those bureaucratic requirements for people seeking Medicaid coverage. You mentioned the work requirements and then those twice a year renewals. That might not sound so bad. Is there a thought that, though, those would be barriers, these would be obstacles that prevent people who are eligible for Medicaid coverage from getting it because of those requirements?
That is the significant concern that many people have for this program. What we have seen in other states, several other states over the past decade have tested work requirements, most notably Arkansas, but other states as well. And we do have evidence to show that work requirements cost states a lot of money to administer because we need states to verify people are working and how many hours they're working or attending school or caring for a sick or needy relative. And they need to collect all the information. But people, they have difficulty running those systems, and people have difficulty complying with all of the reporting requirements. So what we've seen in other states and in Arkansas is that many of the people who are eligible for the program and are, in fact, working have still lost their coverage simply because of the paperwork requirements. What the Government Accountability Office and the CBO have projected is savings from these requirements, not because of people who are ineligible, who are not working, losing coverage, but simply because people are becoming uninsured.
How big a share of Medicaid recipients are we talking about here? This notion that, these are, for the work requirements in particular, I should say, these are able-bodied adults with no kids. How substantial a portion of Medicaid coverage is that category?
Oh, it's a very minor percentage of overall Medicaid enrollees. What we have in Wisconsin right now is we have about 190,000 what we refer to as childless adults enrolled in Badger Care. But what we know from other studies is about 64% of childless adults who are enrolled in Medicaid are already engaged in employment. They just don't get health coverage through their employment. And that the other 25 to 30% of those people are in school or caring for a sick relative or somebody else in need in their household. So there may be like 6 to 8% of that group who would not otherwise be either working or in school. And generally that group, you heard about, from members of Congress, they're concerned that we have, young men sitting in their basements watching video games or playing video games or whatever. That group is generally people who are just temporarily moving through the program. And maybe there are very few people who, yes, are sitting on the program. Young men do not generally use health care. And so it's not a big cost to the program.
On that note, some supporters of these changes have said this will keep undocumented immigrants from using various Medicaid programs. My understanding is for most, I don't know, programs, they wouldn't be eligible even before this legislation. Do I have that right?
There is no eligibility for undocumented immigrants in Medicaid except for emergency Medicaid for women who are in labor and delivering at the hospital. So undocumented immigrants in Wisconsin don't otherwise have access to coverage through the Medicaid program. And so when an undocumented immigrant woman appears at a hospital, she will have temporary coverage to pay the hospital for the delivery of her of her baby. And that coverage will only deal with that episode. And that's all. There are new restrictions, however, from this bill for fully legally present immigrants and refugees who have come in this country legally and have been authorized by the U.S. government to be in this country as refugees who will no longer be eligible for the program.
Donna Friedsam is with us, former health policy programs director at UW-Madison, emerita researcher there, looking at the new budget bill, what it means for Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act in Wisconsin. Donna, you mentioned changes to the Affordable Care Act. What do you see there that could impact us here in Wisconsin?
So I also want, this is an important thing I think for people to be aware of, is that along with these changes to Medicaid, there are going to be changes in the Affordable Care Act, where there's going to be quite a few new rules for enrollment verification. There's going to be restrictions in the time frame for people to enroll. And there will no longer be what's called automatic re-enrollment. So in Wisconsin right now, we have about 300,000 Wisconsin residents enrolled in the ACA marketplace, and about a third of them rely on automatic re-enrollment every year rather than resubmitting all of their paperwork and every year. And that will no longer exist. So every year, people will need to go through the process again in order to continue their plans. This is expected to create a barrier to continued coverage. But in addition, the premiums, the enhanced premium tax credits that we've had over the past 4 or 5 years are not going to continue. So what the actuarial firms are projecting is that we're going to see up to a 75% increase in overall premiums in the marketplace over the coming year, could work out to an average of about $1,300 annually. It's important to note that while a lot of people who take coverage in the marketplace do have access to subsidies, in Wisconsin, we actually have quite a few people who are up into the middle incomes who rely on marketplace coverage. And we have quite a few people ages 55 to 64 pre-Medicare who rely on market price coverage, who are not low income necessarily. These people, these residents, will be seeing substantial increases in their premiums. So all of these things are expected to increase the or decrease people's ability to participate or access health insurance coverage and likely increase the uninsured in our state.
In just our last minute, another big point of concern, Donna, hospitals, especially rural hospitals and their financial situation. What are you watching for the impact of this bill?
Well, you've all seen the headlines that rural hospitals are going to be stressed. We did see a bill in the budget bill in the state, kind of a last minute effort for the state to be able to pull down additional federal matching dollars through Medicaid, $1.1 billion, that should help the rural hospitals somewhat. So I think they will be able to get more money to help. But I think it's unfortunate that what we're doing is we're providing these emergency funds to save the hospitals because we're taking away insurance coverage for individuals. I think it's going to stress hospitals overall. We do see a lot of projections that, about 30,000 people in rural Wisconsin will lose their Medicaid coverage. And we have quite a number of rural hospitals that'll be stressed with this changes ahead.
Donna, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Donna Friedsam, Distinguished Researcher Emerita and former Health Policy Programs Director at UW-Madison. Been talking about how the passage of the new federal budget bill could affect Medicaid and Badger Care recipients in Wisconsin, along with rural clinics and hospitals.
Coming up, the Census Bureau is in flux under the Trump administration with its handling of data and public trust issues. A Marquette University political scientist explains the consequences.
Even if there is a 1% undercount of the Wisconsin population, it means hundreds of millions of dollars in lost federal aid.
The new book is called Counting Like a State. That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Census Bureau takes an official count of the population every 10 years. And what may seem like a simple headcount is actually a major undertaking.
The Wisconsin author of a new book on the census says it requires years of preparation, especially now in the middle of the decade, and getting an accurate count has high stakes.
The census determines how many congressional seats each state gets, along with the allocation of trillions of federal dollars for programs like Medicaid and Head Start.
But the Census Bureau is in flux under the Trump administration with growing concerns that the 2030 count could run into trouble.
Philip Rocco is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. His new book is called Counting Like a State, How Intergovernmental Partnerships Shape the 2020 U.S. Census. Phil, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good to be with you, Kate.
You include a quote from a Greek economist early on that says, statistics is a combat sport. How does that apply to the U.S. Census?
So if you think about the census, it is the primary way that we get the information that we use to allocate seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Electoral College, do redistricting at the state level, and allocate trillions of dollars in federal and state aid around the country. So the census allocates political power around the country. It also allocates a significant amount of resources, and thus it is not a stranger to political conflict because of the stakes, the political power stakes involved in decisions about how we count people, who gets counted, And what we try to do to correct for the fact that on a fairly routine basis, numerous Americans are undercounted or systematically missed from the census. So the point is that politics, because the census shapes the allocation of power and resources, politics really enters into the way that we count ourselves in a kind of profound way.
And indeed, you dedicate the book to the uncounted. Who does the census miss?
So historically, the census has undercounted people of color, Hispanic Americans, often in many senses Asian Americans, people in the Native American community, as well as people who are lower income, people who are renters, as opposed to owning a house. There are a lot of populations that are systematically undercounted by the census. And while the undercount has generally speaking gotten better decade after decade, 2020 was sort of a reversion of that trend. It was the highest undercount for a number of those populations since 1990.
You also called 2020 a perfect storm. What made the 2020 census so difficult?
Take your pick. So this is the thing, is that I started writing this book years before the pandemic hit. And already people were talking about the census in 2020 as a perfect storm. I'll give you a few examples. So first, you had a pattern of congressional underfunding for key census operations, which meant that especially as new technologies were being brought online, it was more difficult for the Bureau to kind of pilot test some of those technologies. Additionally, prior to the pandemic, people might not remember, there was a very tight labor market, which means that it was harder to hire census enumerators than it had been in past decades. The 2010 census took place during the Great Recession, so a lot easier to hire enumerators, people to go and count and so forth in that census. Additionally, you had several initiatives by the Trump administration to essentially engineer an undercount of communities with large numbers of undocumented immigrants by introducing, for the first time, a citizenship question on the census questionnaire. And as was later revealed through public records requests, a very deliberate effort on the part of a Republican strategist named Tom Hoefler to shift power in the House of Representatives towards, in his words, quote, Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. So even before the pandemic, there were a number of operational and political challenges that made this 2020 census really, really difficult to conduct.
But from the outside looking in, we might think of the census as just this really straightforward, simple headcount. Why is it way more complex than that?
The census is one of the most difficult projects that the federal government conducts. And one of the main reasons why is that convincing people that they should voluntarily fill out a census form on their own and return it to the federal government, especially in a climate where there's a lot of distrust of the government and where the purposes of the census, this thing that happens once every 10 years, when you compare it to other events in politics, you know, elections are every 2 or 4 or 6 years, it can be very difficult to persuade people, even if they trust that their data are going to be kept confidential and private, that there is some return in the end for them taking the time out of their day and providing that form. And if you think about the composition of the United States population, it's growing, it's changing where it is, the residential housing stock, where you would want to reach people to count them, is morphing as cities grow, as there's an oil boom in North Dakota, you get new colonies of mobile homes for the workers there. It's just a very dynamic population, and a population whose relationship to the federal government isn't one where there's necessarily going to be a lot of trust. And so this thing that would seem really simple to do conceptually or on paper is, historically speaking, one of the hardest things that we do.
As you talk about trust, it reminds me that you spend time in your book talking about how states are really relying on these trusted messengers then to go out, fan out, to educate and really activate the hardest to count populations to fill out the census. Can you talk more about how states have done that and where states fall short?
Yeah, so I'll just begin by saying for decades, the Census Bureau, really when they started doing what's known as the self-enumeration census or mail response, in other words, on the first instance, you're sent a form or an invitation to fill the census out online now and return it, the Census Bureau has known that it's really important to reach people, not just through advertising, through commercials, through billboards and so forth, but through networks of trust. In other words, relying on officials and community leaders who people already know to receive messages from those people about why it's important and safe to fill out your census. The reality is, as important as those outreach campaigns have been, it is not the case that all of the states and cities where undercounts are going to be really likely did the same level of investments.
And you found Wisconsin invested $0 for the 2020 census, whereas our neighbor Illinois invests over $30 million. New York City, you point out, spending roughly $40 million on census outreach. So why was there this disparity in support between states?
Well, there's four basic things that I talk about in the book that help explain kind of why you see these different levels of investment. So first, for states and cities and other units of government, the census is not in fact their responsibility. Even though they are affected by the census, they are not, so to speak, legally on the hook for that outreach. So if they don't do it or it's underinvested in, the sense that there's going to be attribution of blame is somewhat more muted. Second, not every state, city, county is at the same risk of being undercounted. As a state, Wisconsin's response rate to the census is actually fairly good, although there are pockets in the state where historically undercounted populations are far more numerous. Cities like Milwaukee would be one example, as well as some tribal areas in the state where the undercount is a bit higher. And so there can be differential incentives, I guess you would say, for states with different sizes of undercounted population. But additionally, there is a partisan political tenor to these investment decisions. In some states, the politics of investing in the census were just kind of politically poisoned by the Trump administration's efforts to put a citizenship question on the census. And I have interviews with folks who are working for Republican governors, and they're saying, look, the governor understands that it's really, really important to invest in the census, but they're worried about being primaried, and thus even mentioning the census is sort of politically off limits. And then in states like Wisconsin, the census funding for outreach kind of got caught up in a pretty predictable budget battle between a Democratic governor and a Republican state legislature. So that's just sort of normal politics of a divided government can affect it as well. And then finally, there are states, cities, and counties where the level of resources that those governments have to expend on the census are very, very small. And especially when you have a number of programs that it's sort of mandatory to fund, the census can be seen by elected officials as a nice to have rather than a must have, even if, and this is really important, even if there's going to be a huge effect on federal funding or even representation from an undercount. The state of Florida is kind of an interesting example. I think the state in 2020 was undercounted by about 750,000 people. And there have been calculations that over a decade, that might mean anywhere from $11 to $21 billion in losses in federal aid.
Wow. We're talking with political scientist Philip Rocco from Marquette University. The new book about the 2020 census, it's called Counting Like a State. Philip, let's look closer to home, the situation with Whitewater, communities that are undercounted. You mentioned a lot is on the line here. Can you talk more about the recounts, what the count question resolution program is, and how did it change the situation for Whitewater after the 2020 census?
Yeah, so I want to emphasize that the census doesn't really allow for recounts, as we might think. If you are just because your city might have been undercounted or your state might have been undercounted, the census's hands are kind of tied in responding to that. But if there are errors in where certain pockets of your population were assigned geographically in the census file, it is possible through a program called Count Question Resolution to issue a challenge and then to have a population correctly located. And often this happens with populations in college towns or in places where there are incarceration facilities. But the reality is that process has very tight regulations on what kinds of challenges can be brought forward. And I want to emphasize that just because you think your city was undercounted, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to prevail in a count question resolution in challenge. And so, I mean, one of the big takeaways, I think, from the book is that it's really, really, really important that the census kind of gets it right the first time, because once the census is done, the opportunities that you have for making corrections are fairly limited.
You talk about how ahead of the 2030 census, or any census for that matter, it's the middle years that really determine the quality of the census and those investments in the middle of the decade, which is now. You know, like the design and the testing of the questionnaires and preparing address lists and the outreach plans. How is this looking now for the next census count in 2030?
I think census advocates are in general fairly concerned about the quality of the 2030 census for a variety of reasons. I think on the one hand, you have the Trump administration. There's been some signals that they will try to reintroduce a citizenship question on the 2030 questionnaire. And frankly, whether or not they do, they have taken some steps, including in recent weeks in Los Angeles and other cities, to kind of create a climate of distrust that might have kind of the same effect on the census environment and the incentives of people to respond to the 2030 count. And so that's pretty worrisome. Additionally, in the early months of the Trump administration, there's been eliminations of 1,000 full-time equivalent employees at the Census Bureau. The administration has disbanded several important advisory committees, including a scientific advisory committee for the Census Bureau, which is really important in ensuring that the Bureau is using kind of the latest techniques and that it's meeting its operational milestones. That kind of oversight is really important. And then additionally, there are some real questions about the adequacy of congressional funding for the 2030 census and whether or not the funding is going to be adequate for piloting some of the key operations that'll be necessary to for the census to be ready operationally in time for 2030. So there are, and in many ways, similar to the last decade, some real concerns about whether or not we're doing what we need to do right now to ensure that the 2030 census is as best as it can be.
So, Phil, as we close, what is your advice to states like Wisconsin as we move closer to this next census? What should states do?
Well, I would say a few things. So first, for both states and, you know, if not states, then certainly cities and counties where there are high pockets of historically undercounted people, and you can look at data sources on the 2020 census to see some examples of that. There is a real value to investing in census outreach. Even if there is a 1% undercount of the Wisconsin population, it means hundreds of millions of dollars in lost federal aid for programs like Medicaid. So there's a real value in investing in that kind of outreach. The second thing I would say is that if it's the case that states can't make those kinds of investments in outreach, then they should be using every aspect of their bully pulpits and the networks of people that they have relationships to, including community-based organizations, to get the word out about the fact that the census matters for the resources and representation we have, and that it's safe and confidential to fill out. And then third, I would say for people who are just sort of wondering about what they can do, you can write to your elected officials at the state level, at the local level, to ask them, what are we doing to prepare ourselves for the 2030 census? What are we doing to invest in outreach? And then additionally, rather than simply waiting for a response, ask what you can do in the communities that you live in with a community-based organizations you're most familiar with to ensure that everybody in the place that you live knows those things about the census and is ready to take the 2030 census.
Phil, thank you for your research. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Kate.
That is Marquette University political scientist Philip Rocco. His new book is called Counting Like a State, How Intergovernmental Partnerships Shaped the 2020 U.S. Census. And it lays out the importance of state and local cooperation in census taking and how local community involvement affects this once-in-a-decade effort.
Coming up, a new professional ballet company founded in Elkhorn will bring its productions to small communities.
And I think it's really exciting because there's a lot of people there who I think deserve to be able to see something of that caliber without having to drive all the way to Milwaukee or Madison.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A new professional ballet company aims to expand access to this demanding art form in smaller Wisconsin communities.
The Wisconsin Dance Theater is kicking off its first season with an original ballet set at the end of World War II. It's called A Hero's Homecoming, and it will premiere in Elkhorn. The show has performers from all over the country, but the core of the production is from brothers Samuel and Joseph Huberty.
The brothers grew up in Elkhorn, where their mom owned a dance studio for many years. Ballet was at the center of their lives. Today, they are professional ballet dancers. Their work has taken them around the country and around the world.
Samuel Huberty is director of the Wisconsin Dance Theater. He is the creator, artistic director, and a performer in A Hero's Homecoming. And Joseph Huberty dances with the First State Ballet Theater in Delaware and is one of the performers in this new production. Sam and Joe, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us so much.
Sam, you first. You're the director of the Wisconsin Dance Theater Company. Why launch a professional ballet company in Wisconsin now?
So my wife and I moved back to the U.S. in October of 2023, and we felt it was, we were young, we're ready to do this, and we felt like this was the appropriate time to be able to take a risk and pursue a dream of ours, which was to open a company and be able to produce our own works and productions and have a bit more of artistic freedom.
What is the artistic vision for the new dance company?
Well, I'd love to be able to make works that I feel the public can relate better to. You know, oftentimes when we're doing a show, if it's something like Sleeping Beauty, right, is about the French court system in, you know, your 17th century France, a lot of the pantomime and things, it's becoming difficult to relate to. for a lot of people. You know, if you had watched that 200 years ago or something of that nature, you know, you still, like, royalty is still fairly relevant in the world, and the world's changing, things are evolving, and a lot of the classic stories, while they're fantastic and they're great, sometimes they're difficult to relate to as an everyday person in a modern world. So what we're doing is trying to produce works that are more accessible to people and provide them with more context that they understand naturally, that fits in better with their day-to-day lives.
I wonder, Joe, you know, as you see Sam, your brother, launching this, how would you describe ballet dance in Wisconsin? Are we like a hidden gem, or is there something that is holding back our state in dance?
I think especially in the area that they're in, there's not much classical ballet there, or really any professional caliber company. And I think it's really exciting because there's a lot of people there who I think deserve to be able to see something of that caliber without having to drive all the way to Milwaukee or Madison, because those are where two of the major ballet companies are in Wisconsin. And those are about the only two in Wisconsin.
Joe, how did you get into dance in the first place?
Our mom owned a ballet studio in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. And I had three brothers. Two of them danced with my mom already at the studio. And I was probably like 8 at the time. And I was like, well, I want to spend more time with my mom, because we would go to school and it's a dance studio. So obviously it happens after school, because the students then have to go take class at the ballet studio. So I would come home and she wouldn't be there, and I would want to be with her, obviously. So I started taking ballet classes to be with her.
Sam, what did your mom teach you about ballet and about life as a dancer?
I think she really instilled a love for the art form itself and for the work. So not just, I think a lot of people, you really enjoy, like, we call them the shiny things, right? Like, it's, you get a fantastic costume and people clap for you and it's a lot of fun. But the work itself, I think that she was able to provide us with a sense of joy and going into the studio every day and going through your exercises and working and, you know, the training and development aspect of it. That's what a lot of your time is spent doing. You know, most of your time is in the studios rehearsing and training, and you perform, you know, if you're lucky, maybe 2 or 3 days a week, you know, for a few hours, but the rest of the time is in the studio. So she really had a great way of instilling that love of what the actual work was that was required to do the performance. And then within the student body, developing a really good sense of community. It's kind of fun. One of the things I love about dance is it doesn't necessarily matter who you are or where you're from. You're all sort of speaking the same language, regardless of what language you actually speak, you know? So when we would travel, when I was performing in Israel, we'd have rehearsals that are being run in French, Russian, and Hebrew. And I only speak English, you know, I speak some very broken French and a little bit of Hebrew. And so it was amazing because we could all still cooperate and we're all friends and getting along and laughing and telling jokes. But, you know, most of us didn't speak, there was no one in the room who spoke all 4 languages fluently. So I think, you know, I'd credit my mom with giving us that ability to work with people, you know, regardless of circumstance, and finding joy in it.
Joe, do you find that there are stigmas or barriers to break down for men in dancing? You come with all these brothers who were dancers and it was just part of the family, but outside of your close-knit family, what has it been like?
Ballet is a very small community, I would say. Like, it's in like every country everywhere, but it's very tight-knit. In my company that I dance with right now, First State Ballet Theater, there's about 20 to 25 dancers in it, and half of them are men. To me, being in that community, there is no stigma, because half of my coworkers are also men who dance for a living. I can see that looking at it from the outside, maybe there is some sort of stigma about it, but I think it's mostly due to a lack of understanding what the art form is and like why men are in the art form. Because if you look at like Sleeping Beauty, that story can't exist without men in it. Right?
Yeah.
Like it could, but the original story is, you know, the prince comes and wakes her up and all this stuff, and there's suitors, you know, you like men are part of that story and they're very important in ballet. And I think that the stigma you talk about is due to the lack of understanding that there is. And I think it's just something that isn't really explained or talked about from the perspective of the male dancer to the outside world.
We are talking with Joe and Sam Huberty. They are ballet dancers from Elkhorn, and they are performing in the new production titled A Hero's Homecoming. Sam, in terms of this production and getting it off the ground, this, you know, it's set around soldiers at the end of World War II. Can you talk more about what the story is about and how you are driving it to bring it to the stage?
I'd say that the process of creating the production, while stressful, has been an absolute blast. I've been loving every minute of it. You know, it's so much fun. In terms of the story, it's kind of an odd, we took sort of an odd approach to it. So there isn't inherently one main character. It's sort of, we're following four different vignettes that all interact with each other. The 40s were such an interesting time. Like the World War II is fascinating, and you see so many people are so interested in it because it was such a conflict of ideologies, and so much change happened in such a short period of time. And you know, sometimes when massive changes occur in your life, it takes a minute to adjust. But when that happens on a large scale with everyone around you, how do you fit back into your life, right? So if you had gone off to war, and you know, the understanding was like, if you got drafted and you went, like you were there till the war was done. And, you know, people changed it culturally within the US. You know, you have the cultural icons like Rosie the Riveter, right? So the women were now going into factories and plants and working, and now everyone's come home, the war is done. So how does everyone fit back into society when all of the roles have now been changed and the game board's kind of been flipped on its head? So it's fun to follow all of these different options because it's such a complicated matter. I felt as though if you just had one character that we were following, you couldn't necessarily get the full scope of the impact on the community and the culture. And so we followed different ways that people could have made choices. So in essence, it could be one character and all of the choice options they had, but they're all playing out at the same time. So yeah, it's a ton of fun. And I think it, because the story is told in that way, as we're reviewing the show and going through it, it keeps the show moving really well. Like it never really has it. And I didn't feel as though it had a lull in the show. You know, sometimes you have scenes where it's like, oh, you know, I'm not a big fan of it, but this one keeps moving really well. And I think it's very stimulating for people to watch. And I hope people enjoy it.
Joe, why join your brother and perform together? And how long has it been?
I don't know the year that we last danced together, but it was at least 5 years ago, I think, was the last time we danced together. Earlier, we talked about the stigma of men in ballet, and it's good to have people to lean on who understand the struggles of being a man in ballet. So I think that I am very excited to see what Sam does with all of this. He is a visionary, basically, is how I'm going to put it. He gets these ideas and somehow, some way, he makes them work no matter what gets in his way. And it's really amazing to watch. And I don't think many people like him exist. And like, it's awesome to be able to call him my brother. And I'm so proud of him for doing this.
So when you're learning these ballet routines, you're not looking at your brother, Sam, and being like, what are you asking me to do? You want me to do these steps? And I wonder, is there at all any healthy rivalry or competition between the two of you?
I don't know. Well, I mean, like, it's been 5 years since we've danced together. Sure. And it's, at this point, we have gone in completely different directions in our careers. And I think we both kind of know that. And so we're just at different places. So I think there's still a little bit of healthy rivalry and competition there. But that's the same with any coworker that you have in ballet. There always is a bit of healthy competition because you always want to be better and you always want to be better than yourself the day before. In that essence, yes, there is. I would consider there to be a bit of competition between us. But I'm never like, you want me to do that?
Is that fair, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and Joe's such a good sport because sometimes I've trouble articulating, especially when I'm trying to get so much out of my brain at once. And so I sent Joe and Pearl this video for a pas de deux, and Jordan and myself are marking it, and we're saying, and I'm just trying to talk through it as fast as I can so that we can get, you know, as so we can start working on things faster. And they were such good sports. And they took this crazy video and they've been working on it, you know, and they're not asking, because a lot of it, it's like, it's not necessarily the detail of the choreography. Like, it's important, but the largest aspect is the story. And Joe really, he's very wise in his approach to things. Like, he really understands that, you know, to get your audience invested, like, they're not necessarily going to care if you're one a difference in a pirouette or something, you know, like, it might make a change aesthetically, but the storytelling element is the most important part, especially when you're doing a show like this. And so they're willing to work with me as I'm trying to get all this information out of my brain as quickly as possible. And there's absolutely healthy competition. You know, I was telling my wife the other day, I was like, oh man, because Joe's very good. You know, he really is. He's a really good dancer. I think he's probably way more talented than me. And I was like, oh man, I've been working so hard. I really hope he doesn't come and completely school me on stage. So I absolutely, yeah. You know, I think, because you always, you know, it's the best thing that you can be in when you're working with people is you don't necessarily want to be the best in terms of like, you don't want to, you want to be competing with the people around you. You want to have that challenge and that ability to keep having a healthy contest with each other. For the audience too, I think it benefits everybody, right? Mm-hmm. For the dancers, it keeps us engaged. It keeps us moving and working and trying. And as a result, the product is just better. You know, the final, what gets on stage is just that much better. And it's more entertaining for the audience. It's just more engaging.
Sam and Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That is Sam and Joe Huberty. They are professional ballet dancers and brothers from Elkhorn. They are both starring in A Hero's Homecoming that premieres Saturday in their hometown. Coming up on the show tomorrow, we're highlighting a Lutheran church in Milwaukee, St. Marcus, that is commemorating its 150th anniversary. And the longtime pastor of St. Marcus wrote a book documenting its milestones and especially how the Brewers Hill neighborhood changed around the church and its congregation.
And we want to know, have you ever dug into, maybe documented the history of something in your community, whether it's a church, a historic building, a program you're involved in, or maybe it's family genealogy?
What did you learn in the process of doing this work? What pictures did you find, and what archives did you look into to piece it all together? And once the project was finished, how did you feel? We'd love to incorporate your story in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.